Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to the April edition of First Thursday. This is LRIS's podcast on recent developments in public safety labor relations. My name is Will Aitchison, and we've got quite a jam-packed podcast for you this time. I've got five cases that I want to talk about that I think have some level of significance, including our first genetic information discrimination case filed by a police officer or a firefighter, and it is a pretty important case. But first, I want to talk about something that doesn't involve case law, and that is what is going on in legislatures around the country. We have never seen as much anti-public safety legislation pending in the various state houses around the country as we do now. In almost every state across the nation, you will find legislation, often cookie-cutter legislation. It's written using identical words that would strip law enforcement officers and firefighters of some portion, or in some cases, all of their collective bargaining rights. There are, to be sure, certain areas of focus of this legislation. There are bills in almost every state that would turn states into a right-to-work state, where employees would have the right to not pay union dues, even though they would receive benefits, could demand benefits from the union. There are bills in many states that would make paid release time for union duties off limits, make that illegal. There are bills that would restrict the topics on which collective bargaining can be held, limiting police officers, firefighters to bargaining just over wages and benefits. And it goes on and on and on. We're now in the fourth month of the legislative sessions in most states, and usually legislative sessions last about 6 months, which means we're about to see a lot of action on these various bills. I point this all out to you simply by way of saying that where sometimes I end up thinking that, you know, what goes on in the courts and in individual bargaining agreements is the most important in public safety. In fact, what goes on in a legislature can far supersede that. These bills are part of a national agenda. Many of them come out of training sessions held by what's known as the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC is the abbreviation. This is a organization funded by large corporations, and including a large source of funding is the Koch brothers. And this is an organization that distributes what it refers to as model legislation to friendly legislators around the country. That's why we're seeing the cookie cutter nature of this legislation. At any rate, I just wanted to point out to you, it's out there. It's in state legislatures everywhere. I am recording this in Oregon. Oregon is about as blue of a blue state as you could ever want. And there are bills in our legislature that would, for example, make the appeal of discipline by police officers an illegal subject of bargaining. And that's in a blue state. I'm right next door to the state of Washington. And that's just as blue as Oregon is. And there are bills in the state legislature in Washington that would, for example, require all police and fire unions to annually publish all of their financial information and to periodically get recertified by their membership, or else they'd lose the right to be the exclusive bargaining agent for employees. This is all over the place. And if you're not paying attention to what's going on in your legislature, you're not paying attention to something that could have a substantial impact on the work life of employees. Let's turn now to the case law. And I did want to start with this GINA case, Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act case. This is one that comes to us out of the Moraine, Ohio Fire Department. A little bit of background first about GINA. GINA has been with us now a number of years. GINA actually was signed by the last President Bush. And we've seen some litigation under GINA. GINA prohibits discrimination on the basis of genetic information. We've seen some litigation, and much of that litigation has actually been filed by the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission and involves private sector employers. This case, this fire department case out of Ohio, is different in both respects. First of all, it's not filed by EEOC. It's filed by a firefighter who, from reading the court's opinion in this case, was amazingly well advised as to his rights under GINA throughout the proceeding. And secondly, it is a case that involves a public safety agency. So what's going on in the case? And the case, by the way, also has a significant age discrimination issue that is buried in it that I think is pretty important as well. So what's going on in this case? Well, this is a case involving David Lee. He's a firefighter, EMT, and had been one for 16 years. His labor organization is Local 2981 of the IAFF, and for a number of years, the city and Local 2981 had been batting around in collective bargaining physical fitness standards. And they might involve, or the discussion involved, things like testing, for example, physical fitness testing, visits to doctors, and the like. Eventually, the city, pursuant to one of these agreements, the city implemented a physical examination process with a doctor. And the city drew a curious line with respect to the physical examination, what employees would have to do with respect to doctors. If you were under the age of 40, you only had to fill out a questionnaire if you were a firefighter. If you were over the age of 40, you actually had to not only fill out a questionnaire, but go in for a full physical examination with the doctor. David Lee, you can guess this, was over the age of 40. He was 43 years old. He got the questionnaire in the mail, and one of the questions was, is there a family history of heart disease with your parents or siblings? Lee filled out the questionnaire, and then in early 2012 was scheduled for his full over 40 physical examination with the city's doctor. Lee showed up, told the doctor's office, look, I don't want the over 40 exam. I want to do just what people under 40 do, fill out the questionnaire. I don't want to do the full examination, the full cardiac workup, and you can't draw a line based on age between people who are under 40 and over 40. Oh, and by the way, Lee says, that question you asked on the questionnaire about family history of heart disease, that violates GINA. That asks for genetic information, and under GINA, an employer can't even ask an employee to disclose medical information. Well, Lee's actions at the doctor's office, of course, prod a lot of discussion between the doctor and the city, and eventually the fire chief issues a direct order to Lee that he had 30 days to complete his physical examination consistent with the department's rules. Lee responds by filing a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. And he files a discrimination charge citing both the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, you're discriminating against me because of my age, and GINA. As the EEOC proceeding is going on, there's an internal appeals process for Lee, because the city has now teed him up for potential discharge. There's an internal appeals process. Lee goes through that internal appeals process, and while that decision is pending, he changes his mind. He decides that in order to avoid losing his job, he would take the over 40 physical, but he would continue to maintain his EEOC complaint. The city says, not good enough for us, and fires Lee on March 28th, 2012, 2 days before Lee was scheduled to take his physical examination. The department's rationale for firing Lee was that he could not, and I'm quoting, cure insubordination by an after-the-fact attempt at compliance. And the department also clearly disbelieved that Lee was doing anything other than stalling for more time. Eventually, EEOC issues Lee what's called a right to sue letter, meaning you can file your own lawsuit in court. Lee did, and the case ended up before a federal court. And the federal court found that the city violated both the Age Discrimination in Employment Act and GINA. As to ADEA, the court said, city, you are drawing a line in the sand based upon age. We get it if you want to test for example, potential cardiac or lung problems in firefighters. We understand that. We understand that you might be able to show that that is a bona fide occupational requirement to go through that testing. But what we don't understand is how it is you can draw a line on whether firefighters have to submit to that testing based upon their age. And here's the words of the court on the issue. The city provides copious evidence in case law that testing and histories of coronary disease are bona fide job requirements of firefighters, but offers no evidence or case law as to why it is not a bona fide job requirement for firefighters of all ages. And the court ends up saying that the city has discriminated against Lee by requiring him to undergo job requirements that the employer did not ask employees who were under 40, without any basis for that line in the sand at age 40. Interesting case. We don't see too many ADEA cases floating around involving police officers and firefighters. This is an interesting case, and I think, you know, from my bully pulpit here in Oregon, I think a pretty obvious case of age discrimination. An employer really can't be saying age 40 is the dividing line where people after the age of 40 are subject to more rigorous standards. All right, now let's get to what I think is the juiciest part of the opinion, GINA. Remember, GINA forbids an employer from even asking an employee to produce medical genetic information. And the court says GINA's requirements on this are clear. The court cites the statute as saying that the employer can't even ask, much less require, as the city did Lee, an employee to provide genetic information. And genetic information, in turn, says the court, is defined by GINA as including the very sort of family medical history demanded on the forms used by the city's doctors. But wait a minute, says the city. We didn't use those forms. The doctor used those forms, and we're not liable for whatever it is the doctor did. Here's how the court resolved that issue. The court says the city points out that the doctor added the family history of heart disease question to a basic OSHA questionnaire, as if this absolves the city of responsibility for the doctor's actions. The city's position, says the court, is thwarted by GINA's definition of employer as a person either employing a certain number of employees or as any agent of the employer. The city's position that it's not responsible for the doctor's action is further eroded by the city's failure to comply with GINA regulations that require an employer must tell healthcare providers not to collect genetic information, including family medical history. Where we are procedurally with this case is the court's now ruled in Lee's favor on both his age discrimination and genetic discrimination claims. So what the court does is set a trial on the issue of how much money the city is going to end up paying Lee. The GINA part of this opinion is a real good reminder for employers. You need to scrub your communications with your doctors. You need to take a good hard look at them and make sure that doctors on your behalf are not collecting anything that falls within GINA's definition of genetic information. And that definition is a broad one and does, as this court found, include family medical history. A question as innocuous as, has any member of your family suffered from coronary disease? A question as innocuous as that can violate GINA and subject an employer to liability. While we're talking about discrimination and while we're talking about firefighters, I want to shift gears a little bit and go on over to the District of Columbia Fire Department. Firefighter there by the name of Manu Kennedy, and an issue that recurs time and time again with respect to, in particular, firefighters, although there's some police officer cases on this. And that issue concerns whether or not a no beards policy violates any federal law. Manu Kennedy, the firefighter that we're talking about, is African American. He suffers from a condition that is known as pseudofolliculitis barbae. It's usually called PFB. That's a skin condition, an infection, that disproportionately affects African American men and can lead to irritation and infection when one shaves one's face closely. Kennedy went to his dermatologist, who recommended that he maintain a 1/8-inch beard to prevent irritation and inflammation, but the department refused to accommodate him. The department said, look, we have a no-beards policy. We have good reason for it because of our respirators, and we are not going to allow you an exception for the no-beards policy. What we will do is allow you to conduct fire inspections for a while, which Kennedy did, and then eventually he was required to resign and did so in 2013. Kennedy filed a lawsuit citing, among other things, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I'll get back to that ADA claim in a minute. But I do want to say that there's nothing in this court's opinion indicating whether Kennedy also filed a race discrimination lawsuit. Many of these PFB, firefighter, police officer cases involve race discrimination claims because of the disproportionate impact of a no beards policy on African American men who suffer from PFB at a much greater rate than men of other races. Kennedy, for whatever reason, either didn't file a race discrimination claim or the court simply wasn't dealing with it in this opinion. There have been some successful race discrimination claims. The ones I can think of are all in law enforcement. There's a long-standing case from the University of Maryland Police Department where a no-beards policy as applied to a police sergeant was ruled to be illegal race discrimination. There's a bunch of law enforcement cases. Firefighter cases go much more in favor of employers, though, where employers are using the form of mask that can be interfered with even by the shortest of beards, or as they're called some places, shadow beards. Any rate, I just want to say that race discrimination issue doesn't pop up in this court's opinion. Yeah, that sort of had me cocking one eye at it, wondering what in the world's going on, but nonetheless, that's the way it is. Now let's get to the meat of the opinion, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that's what Kennedy is saying, is he's saying, look, when you have a rule like this and you refuse to accommodate my disability, PFB, and there's no question, he says, my disability, my condition is a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. If you're not accommodating me, you're violating the ADA. What Kennedy ends up getting confronted with is the extremely convoluted history of the definition of a disability under the ADA. and the court ends up telling Kennedy, you know what? You might win if your loss, if your discrimination, your alleged discrimination here, the application of that rule to you, you might win if that had occurred after 2009, but because it occurred in 2008, you lose. Well, how can that be the case? Well, here's what's going on. When the ADA was first passed back in the 1990s, Congress intended it to be a very expansive law. The preface to the ADA states that the law was intended to cover 36 million Americans. That's one in six of us at the time. But very quickly, a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court, the conservative wing of the Supreme Court, began slicing and dicing the ADA in a way that deeply cut into the law. And by 2008, the Supreme Court's excisions of whole parts of the ADA had gotten to the point where employers were winning well over 95% of ADA lawsuits that had been filed. What was the court doing? Well, it really started in 2002. And to be a disability under the ADA, the employee's condition has to substantially limit one or more major life activities on the part of the employee. It's not enough that you suffer from a physical or mental impairment for you to qualify as being disabled. That impairment has to rise to the level of a substantial limitation of one or more major life activities. And the court focused on that, focused on the major life activity component of that definition. And in a case called Murphy versus United Parcel Service in 1999, the court held that to be regarded as substantially limited in the major life activity of working, which is a major life activity, one must be regarded as being precluded from more than one particular job. And in a case decided the same day involving United Airlines, the court said that what the employee has to prove is that the employee is significantly restricted in the ability to perform either a class of jobs or a broad range of jobs in various classes. And the Supreme Court ties the knot by later holding that what the ADA does is to create a demanding standard, that's the court's phrase, for being qualified as disabled, and requires an impairment to prevent or severely restrict an individual from engaging in a major life activity permanently or in the long term. Well, there's a little bit of a conflict there between what the Supreme Court is saying and what Congress intended. Congress intended this law to apply to 36 million Americans. The Supreme Court is saying this law only applies if employees meet a demanding standard. What happens when you have a conflict like that? Well, we often think of the Supreme Court as being the supreme law of the land, and that's true with respect to interpretations of the Constitution, but it's not true with respect to interpretations of statutes such as the ADA. Congress can always come back and amend the statute, saying, in effect, the Supreme Court got it wrong, and we're going to write language that makes it absolutely clear. And that's precisely what Congress did in 2008 when it passed something called the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act, the ADAAA. The ADAAA instructed courts, particularly the Supreme Court, to construe the definition of disability, and I'm quoting, in favor of broad coverage. And the court takes a direct whack, the Congress took a direct whack at the Supreme Court saying that the term substantially limits is not meant to be a demanding standard. There's no question, back to Firefighter Kennedy in District of Columbia, there's no question that had his case been decided under the ADAAA, Kennedy would have had a viable claim under the law. However, the ADAAA didn't become effective until January 1, 2009, and courts have said it isn't retroactive. Kennedy requested his accommodation for his PFB on July 10, 2008, 5.5 months too early, and the court found that because of that, his case had to be decided under the pre-amendments version of the ADA, which meant Kennedy lost. Why? Because he couldn't show that his PFB disqualified him from that broad class of jobs. The court says, although Kennedy may not be able to perform his particular job of choice as a firefighter, he can still serve in some fire prevention roles and do other jobs. We don't think that the fact that he can't serve as a firefighter is enough of a substantial limitation on his major life on a major life activity to qualify him as being disabled under the pre-amendments version of the ADA. And as a result, the court dismissed Kennedy's ADA claim. Kennedy had an interesting argument. He said, look, you know what? I requested accommodations not only before January 1, 2009, but also many times after it. And the department rejected it. And the court said, too bad, we go back to the first request to decide when the clock starts ticking. So an interesting case, as I mentioned, it's kind of a convoluted history of the ADA. It raises once again this pseudofolliculitis barbi issue in the fire service. I will note that many agencies fire agencies are accommodating firefighters with shadow beards by using different types of masks, and I'm just waiting for the latest round of PFB litigation, both on ADA bases, but also on race discrimination bases. Okay, let's move away from discrimination and get into discipline and an issue that comes up with increasing frequency. What's the relationship of a decertification process through a Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission to disciplinary arbitration? Leading the pack in this area has been Florida. And in Florida, it has not been uncommon in the last 10 years to see employers terminate a peace officer, usually a public safety officer, usually a police officer, terminate a police officer, have the police officer go to arbitration, win, and then the department employer reports the officer to the Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission, which holds a hearing on decertification, decertifies the officer, and then the employer fires the officer. That's been, I don't want to say it's a standard practice in Florida, but it's happened a bunch of times. And of course, Peace Officer Standards and Training Boards are thought, both by employers and by labor organizations, as being a much more employer-friendly forum than binding arbitration. We haven't had too many court decisions out of Florida on the issue, and that's why this one that pops up out of Maryland in the last few weeks, that's why this one I think is kind of interesting. This one involves the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. This is Metro, the subway and train service and bus service that services Washington, D.C. And as you know, Washington, D.C. Is a federal enclave, as if you will. Metro actually services not just Washington, D.C., but also the surrounding areas in the states of Virginia and the state of Maryland. And it has a substantial police force. Two of the officers who were there were Mark Spencer and Sherman Benton. Metro fired both of them. Spencer was fired for excessive force and untruthfulness. Benton was fired for an off-duty domestic dispute with his girlfriend and untruthfulness. The officers were represented by the Fraternal Order of Police. They challenged their terminations in arbitration, and the system there calls for an arbitration board. The Board of Arbitration overturned both firings. The board decided that while Metro had legitimate grounds for disciplining both officers, that a lengthy suspension rather than termination was the appropriate sanction. It ordered Metro to reinstate the officers after their respective suspensions. However, on a separate track, Metro reported, as it had to under statutes, reported to the state of Maryland's equivalent of Post that both officers had been fired. Post pulled the certifications for both officers. And so after the arbitrator's decision, Metro is confronted with, what do we do with these officers? We're ordered by an arbitrator to reemploy them. However, they don't have peace officers certification. So what Metro does is to put them on paid administrative leave pending the officer's request to be recertified. Here's where things get a little funky in this case. Maryland law required Metro to send all investigatory materials, including, and I'm quoting, any derogatory information discovered during the investigation, send that to the Maryland Peace Officers Standard and Training Commission. Metro's police chief enthusiastically welcomed that opportunity. And what he stated was in no uncertain terms to the commission that Metro did not favor the recertification of the officers. To no one's surprise, the commission denies the request for recertification, and then Metro fires the officers a second time. The FOP files a lawsuit, a federal court lawsuit. Metro is a federal agency, files a federal court lawsuit saying, hey, you're not complying with the arbitration awards requiring reemployment, reinstatement of these officers. That dispute ends up before the federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the court turns away the lawsuit. The court says that when the officers were fired on the second occasion, Metro was relying on independent grounds that were never before the boards of arbitration when they considered the initial termination of Spencer and Benton. There's something new, says the court. And the something new is the denial of the request for recertification. And the FOP makes the argument before the court, look, that was that denial of request for recertification, that was kind of a sham proceeding. This was sort of, as Monty Python would put it, a wink, wink, nod, nod thing. Sure, Metro's police chief writes a damning letter to the commission, and then the commission says no recertification. What a shock, says the FOP in sort of a sarcastic moment. And here's how the court deals with that. The court says, we recognize that Metro actively sought to influence the commission by writing letters strongly discouraging recertification of the officers. But whatever Metro's intentions, nothing it did violated the arbitrator's awards. And Metro was permitted, in fact obligated, to forward to the commission any derogatory information. To be sure, says the court, the chief was particularly zealous in carrying out that duty in this instance, maybe to a fault. But the court says the commission had the independent right to either recertify or not recertify, and the commission wasn't a rubber stamp for the authorities' wishes. What should the officers have done? Asked the court, kind of hypothetically. What the court's answer to that is, you know what it should have done was to file grievances challenging the second terminations and taken them to arbitration. That board of arbitrators would have had the authority to have awarded the reinstatement of the officers, telling Metro, in effect, find something to do with these officers. But that didn't happen, and that is not an issue over which we, the court, have any jurisdiction. That's a matter for an arbitration board. So the result is, even though these two officers won in arbitration, they end up losing their jobs because of the decertification process. I will note that this sort of dilemma, or this sort of situation, I guess dilemma is the wrong word, this sort of situation has actually prompted legislation in some states. In the state of Washington, for example, there's no ability for the Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission there to take any action to decertify until the discharge of an officer is final. And the word final is defined as following all appeals, including arbitration. So this sort of situation can't happen in Washington, and that's true in some other states. But that structure didn't exist in Maryland, and the result is that these two officers ended up losing their jobs. I'm going to stay with the discipline issue for just a moment, and I want to talk about, it's not a big issue, but it's something that comes up from time to time, and that is where you find an employee wanting to file a lawsuit against someone who was involved with a disciplinary investigation, someone in a police or a fire department. It could be someone who made statements in an internal affairs investigation. It could be middle-level supervisors who make recommendations as to what discipline should be. Could be a police chief or a fire chief or a sheriff. It could be even a police commission or a fire commission. You will find sometimes public safety officers saying, look, I want to file a defamation lawsuit because the statements made by those people are libel or slander. Libel, by the way, is just the written form of defamation. Slander is the oral form of defamation. Those lawsuits never win. And there's one that came down, I think only a couple of days ago, that is a good illustration of why they don't win. It involved the town of Whitestown, New York, a small law enforcement employer, and a probationary police officer by the name of Michael Fiore. What happens in this case is pretty interesting. I once used to sit on a board of directors for a fire commission, the Scappoose Fire District, and we had all of 2.5 paid employees. It was pretty interesting going to those meetings once a month, and you'd find people from the community coming in saying all sorts of things, and the meetings were, I thought, an example in participatory democracy at work. But you never knew what was going to happen on any given Monday evening. Well, here's what happens during one meeting of the Whitestown Police Commission. An employee of a local tanning salon shows up and told the commissioners that while Fiore, their probationary police officer, was off duty, he'd shown up in the tanning salon and displayed a handgun. And that's not all, said this employee. She also said that before Fiore began working for the department, the owner of the tanning salon saw Fiore masturbating in a tanning booth. That was it for the commission. At that hearing, not at another one, no due process. This is not a permanent employee. This is someone who has no job protections whatsoever. At that meeting, after hearing from the tanning salon employee, the police commission fires Fiore. Fiore then sues the town, claiming, among many other things, that various members of the commission and the department had made defamatory statements against him in the process of considering the discipline. A state court ends up throwing out the lawsuit in the same way that courts throw these lawsuits out routinely. Why? The court says there is a complete immunity from liability for defamation for an official who is entrusted with policy-making decisions and how they go about making those decisions within the ambit of their duties. Here, says the court, the town board, the city council, if you will, has the ability to enforce discipline in the police department. It delegated that authority to the police commission, and in turn, the police commission delegated part of that authority to high-ranking and mid-level supervisors in the department. They are all entitled to absolute immunity for statements that they make in a discharge of their responsibilities about matters of discipline. And this notion of absolute privilege exists in many, many states. In some states, it's not quite what the law refers to as an absolute privilege. It's instead described as a conditional privilege or a qualified privilege that can be lost if the statements were made in malice. But I will tell you, you just really don't ever see defamation claims that are successful made by employees against people who were involved in the disciplinary process. And I think really for very good reason. Otherwise, you'd have folks participating in the discipline who had some real second thoughts about whether or not they'd voluntarily participate in the process. One footnote in Fiore's case, I mentioned he was a probationary. He argued as well in the court that there wasn't just cause for his termination, but the court says, look, we're not going to even get to whether there was just cause. He was probationary. He could be dismissed for almost any reason or no reason at all, and he doesn't have any protections under his collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, we're not even going to consider whether or not he was terminated for just cause. Clearly, the employer had enough to go on to terminate him. The last case I want to talk about comes out of the tragic situation that was known as Black Sunday in the fire department of New York. That was January 23rd, 2005. On that day, you had three firefighters lose their lives, two firefighters and one lieutenant, in two separate fires. And some litigation that comes out of Black Sunday has provided, I think, kind of a very interesting look into state safety laws and whether or not they can provide the basis for liability of an employer. This is a case involving two firefighters, Eugene Stolowski and Brendan Cawley. They were fighting a multi-story fire in Brooklyn when they and other members of their response team became trapped by the flames. The firefighters who were trapped, they were trapped on the fourth story, didn't have adequate ropes, and they had no alternative. They began jumping as much as 50 feet to the ground. That's where a lieutenant and a firefighter perished. Stolowski actually physically threw Cawley to the ground, threw him out of a window. Cawley had less than a month on the job. And then Stolowski jumped himself. Cawley actually suffered the lesser amount of injuries of the two, although he was pretty seriously injured. He had broken ribs, a concussion, and lung damage. Stolowski's injuries were horrific, and he actually came back to work some years later. Stolowski's legs and ribs were fractured. His pelvis was shattered and pushed out from his torso. His heart stopped. His skull had become detached from his spine in what doctors described as internal decapitation. I mean, just horrific injuries. He undergoes 12 surgeries, has all sorts of spare body parts and pieces of metal implanted in his body. And then amazingly, as I mentioned, he actually comes back to work. Well, Stalowski and Cawley and others file a lawsuit against a whole bunch of people, the owner of the building, but notably for our purposes here, the city. And the lawsuit against the city contends that the city had violated New York's safety law. It's called the Public Employee Safety and Health Act, or as they call it in New York, PESHA. And they said, look, their claim was, PESHA, the safety law, imposes a general duty on an employer to provide employees with a safe place of employment, a place of employment that is free from recognized hazards, and that the employer will provide reasonable and adequate protection to the lives, safety, and health of its employees. The city, once it sees this lawsuit, files a motion to dismiss it, saying it didn't violate any relevant government statute or provision, and if it did, the violation didn't cause Stalowski and Cawley's and the others' injuries. That's what tees up this court opinion, is the city's motion to dismiss the lawsuit. And the court says, we're not going to dismiss the lawsuit. We're going to let it move ahead. Why? The court says, there's evidence, and I'm quoting now, including the testimony, including testimony and an investigative report, that the failure to issue ropes to the firefighters contributed to the injuries and deaths suffered when the firefighters jumped from windows using either no safety devices or a single rope that had been independently purchased by one of the firefighters. The court said that in the past, the city had allowed firefighters to bring their personal ropes, but discontinued that practice in the year 2000. And so for a four-year period of time, the city did not allow personal ropes, and we think that raises issues of fact as to whether the absence of ropes not only contributed to the deaths and injuries of the firefighters, but also whether or not it creates liability on the part of the city. The city also filed a motion to exclude from evidence an investigatory report tracing in part the deaths and injuries to the failure to provide ropes. The city said that that should be off limits. The court refused to consider that argument. So apparently that investigative report is going to be in evidence. This is an interesting case from a legal standpoint. A number of states do have what you could think of as the state equivalent to OSHA laws, safe workplace laws. What you don't see in many states at all is the ability to file a lawsuit for violation of those safety laws. Usually, the only remedy is going to be filing a safety complaint with the state safety agency, then able to investigate and order the employer to take remedial action. New York's a bit different in this regard. In fact, I can only think of a couple of other states that are like this, where under some circumstances, a violation of the state safety statute may also give rise to the employer's liability. It'll be interesting to watch this case as it moves through the court system to see how it is resolved. Well, that's it for our April 1st Thursday. Got a lot coming up at LRIS. We are finishing, we're in the final editing process of the 7th edition of our book on the rights of law enforcement officers. I also have finished writing a book on collective bargaining. We're now in the first stages of editing that. Hope to get it out in the next 3 or 4 months. And we have a seminar coming up in April. Check our website, LRIS.com. Got a seminar coming up on collective bargaining in this new economic age that we're in. Hope to see you at a future LRIS event. This is Will Aitchison signing off.